Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia of being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen ad-free.
From Wondery. How are you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing good, Justin. Are you doing good?
I'm okay.
I think you're doing good.
I'm a little tired. Got my third shot and it's wearing me out, but I'm doing okay. Real quick, I was on the Shaping Opinions podcast with Tim O'Brien. We talk about the true crime genre in general and podcast stuff. It's a very interesting conversation. So go and check it out. It's called the Shaping Opinion Podcast. And as most of you know, we're out on TikTok and we have a bunch of cool new designs, t-shirt designs and stuff out on our website, genypod.com.
These new designs are very personal to the show. So if you dig the show and dig, especially if you dig Justin, I think you're going to like these new designs.
So tonight's case takes the husband did it scenario and turns it on its head. So with that, what are we talking about tonight?
Well, tonight we're talking about the November 18th, 2010 murder of Rusty Snyderman in the parking lot of his son's daycare center. This happened in Dunwoody, Georgia.
Rusty Snyderman, he was 36 years old. He was a husband and father of two. He worked as an entrepreneur and earned a master's degree in business administration from Harvard. And then he went on to start his own business and he worked lots of different jobs in finance. Very successful. And he met his wife, Andrea, at the Indiana University, where he was a business student. And they were described as a good team. They got along and they ended up starting a family together.
And they did take their time before they got married. It was said that they lived together for 7 years before they finally tied the knot. And then in the early 2000s, this family moved to Georgia. They're a middle-class family. They had two children, Ian and Sophia. They were a Jewish family and well-known in the Jewish community in Dunwoody.
In 2008, Rusty went out on his own, started his own business. He actually founded three startups before his last business venture. And in early 2010, Andrea was hired as an engineer at General Electric.
She oversaw various projects, but mainly worked under a supervisor, Hemi Newman. Now, that is the setup. These are the players. And the day after my birthday, November 18th, 2010, something terrible happens.
You always have to say when your birthday is. Are you hoping to get some birthday shout-outs, Justin?
Yes, I am.
It's on the morning of November 18th, 2010, when Rusty dropped his two-year-old son off at daycare. Now, his daycare was Dunwoody Prep Preschool.
I didn't realize that 2 years old was when you took kids to daycare. I thought that didn't start until like four or five, but that shows what I know.
Well, later on, you end up taking him to school. But, you know, before this, they had breakfast together. So it was a typical morning, a good morning. He dropped Ian off. His little one went off to the playground. He was going back to his car. Now, we know from surveillance footage that while he was doing that, a silver minivan, a Kia Sedona, pulled into the parking lot. And as Rusty got to his car, a gunman approached him. Now, Rusty wasn't aware of this. He was just going to his car. But this gunman opened fire, firing the gun at close range, and then fled the scene in this minivan and got away. Rusty did not survive this shooting. He died at the hospital from multiple fatal gunshot wounds.
And the last gunshot was pressed up against him as a kill shot.
There were witnesses to this shooting. And according to the witnesses, this gunman was wearing a hooded pullover and appeared to be wearing a fake beard. Now, this vehicle, although we know it's a Kia Sedona, it was initially described as a Dodge minivan, but that was corrected later. One of the witnesses was Chris Lane, and he said that these two men were about 6 feet apart at the most. And like you said, the final bullet, well, it was very close range, pressed up against his face, his neck. The autopsy found soot in Rusty's wound, which confirmed Chris's statement. So when this happens, Justin, people don't understand what's going on. They can see it happening, but their brains aren't ready for it. So apparently these witnesses, some of them thought this may have been a movie or something, or that these men were just acting out.
I mean, there's so many prank YouTube channels. There are so many people that pull these weird scenarios off in public that, you know, we always hear it with mass shootings. People think it's fireworks. You know, we always hear that they thought it was a mannequin because no one's expecting it to be a real dead body. And in this scenario, Rusty's dropping his two-year-old off at, you know, daycare. No one's expecting this to be a shooting gallery. And especially what appears to be a professional hit on a father.
Witnesses said that the shooter didn't run away. He just walked back to the van. So this is a curious case because when police interview people that knew Rusty, you know, whether it was his family or friends or acquaintances, none of them could think of any reason that someone would shoot him like this because he wasn't a problem causer. Do you know what I mean? He never started any trouble. He didn't have any financial trouble. He wasn't involved in any crimes. So it was very confusing because this did seem like a professional hit. A month in, police were still having trouble figuring out the motive here and figuring out who the shooter was.
I find that a little surprising because they had security footage of the parking lot. They have footage of the man and the vehicle, not the license plate, but I just would assume that that's being played on all of the news stations and somebody would watch that and know who that was and whose car that belonged to.
Or at least the vehicle. You would think that would lead them somewhere because you work from the victim out and start trying to compare who would have a vehicle like that. Now, we weren't privy to their investigation, not on that level. So all we know is a month goes by, detectives still can't figure out a motive or who the shooter was. So of course, they go back to Andrea Snyderman and they say, you know, was anyone interested in you? Because maybe someone did this to get him out of the picture. This is just a theory they're coming up with. And she said, well, my boss, Hemi Newman, well, he made a pass at her on a business trip. But she said she just dismissed it and nothing came of it.
In most cases, the husband did it. But in this case, did the spouse do it? Did the wife do it? So this is the only lead they have, and she's not giving them a lot to work with.
But the thing is, they have this theory. They're asking her, was anyone interested in you? And she just mentions her boss and then basically says, but this isn't really tied to anything. This isn't important. But Andrea was lying. Hemi didn't make a pass at her. They had actually been spending time together having an affair.
She will deny this, but there are coworkers and other witnesses that say they were extremely affectionate with each other in public and went on a lot of business trips together.
So the police, they have an idea that she's not coming clean with them. All they have really in this case is they have this van and they're analyzing the daycare security footage. This is in December of 2010. They're looking over this footage and they figure out where this van came from, a local enterprise rent-a-car. And they learn that the person who rented this silver minivan was Hemi Newman.
Go figure, right?
They're looking at the figure in the footage, and obviously it's someone wearing a hood and they have a beard. But when they're looking at the person, it could be someone in a disguise, and it looks like it could be Hemi. So they start looking deeper into this. They find some records, and they learn that he rented the vehicle, went to work early, then left work, returned, and dropped off that vehicle later in the day. So they get the minivan, and they start combing through it. They recover synthetic beard fibers. So now they really believe this person was wearing a fake beard during the shooting. Things are coming together. You know, I think you could say, why did it take so long? But it just depends on where they start. The key here was, as they went back to Andrea and she told them something, and it's one of those leads that despite the person they're talking to saying, don't worry about that, they have a different feeling. And it's paying off because they start going through his phone records, Hemi's phone records. And they find a man that Hemi had called a number of times. His name was Joe Da Silva. So they contact Joe Da Silva. And he tells them, I sold Hemi a 40 caliber handgun in October of 2010. And they said, well, why was he buying this gun? And he said, well, Hemi claimed he needed it for home defense. And here's the strange thing. Hemi called him about a month after that and said, you know, what would it take for you to not talk to anyone about this gun? And he was offering him money. He said that there was a problem with the gun and he needed to get rid of it. And he also said something to the effect of, don't ever get a mistress.
Thank God that criminals are idiots, because I mean, this is the ultimate example of, what were you thinking?
January 4th, 2011, the Dunwoody police arrested Hemi Newman. Now, they did this by calling him to the police station and telling him, we know you rented a minivan. And it's there that they interrogated him for 5 hours. But he was not cooperative.
Did you watch this interrogation, Aaron?
No.
I did. It's so ridiculous because he just sits there and goes, yeah, I had the van, but I can't explain it. I don't know. I can't explain who had the gun and who pulled the trigger.
When you think about this case and you think about how poor Rusty was gunned down in this parking lot, and then the police quickly get their suspect or person of interest in Hemi Newman, he doesn't seem to have any thought at all in how he's going to explain any of his actions or what he was up to. Nothing. This guy literally, allegedly killed this poor guy and has no story to give. He just has nothing to say except, yeah, I had the van.
I think it took a month for them to get this lead, because when they initially questioned Andrea, she just acted like she was in shock of the whole scenario and the whole situation. It took repeated visits and questions before she finally gave them something to go on. So I think they would have had this solved literally the day of, if Andrea had cooperated better.
So not only was Rusty the kind of guy that really be surprised if he was involved in any kind of a case, let alone his own murder, Hemi Newman, same way. This was a successful businessman. He was born in Mexico. They did say that his father had been emotionally abusive and had sent him away to a boarding school in Israel for a time, which they say affected Hemi. They say that he had abandonment issues because of this. Now, when he got older, obviously he started doing well in business, and he lived in an upper middle class neighborhood with his wife and two kids. And neighbors reported that this family, very happy, very close, and they even had barbecues in the summers. So he had been working at GE for 11 years, and that's where he met Andrea. They were working in the same division that oversaw programs that involved nuclear reactors and solar panels. Hemi, no criminal record before this. But, you know, we know for a fact, Justin, that if someone commits a major crime, their behavior usually changes, right? Something changes in their behavior. So that's one of the things that detectives will ask neighbors, friends, family, what do you know about this individual? Did their behavior change? Did anything change with their normal day-to-day patterns? Well, in the weeks after this shooting, the neighbors, they didn't see Hemi for weeks. And they weren't sure if he moved or if he went on an extended vacation. And all anybody knew was he had made a Facebook post that implied that he was on vacation with his family in Florida. It was titled Traveling with the Girls in Florida. He didn't make another post until New Year's 2011. And he just posted to wish his friends and family a happy new year. Because he was having a few financial issues, they thought maybe this is money related. Because, you know, while Andrea lied, we said that, the detectives didn't know. They were still going off the idea that Hemi was interested in Andrea and possibly shot Rusty because of that. But because of some financial issues that they were starting to see, they thought maybe this is about money. You know, Hemi even asked for a public defender. But it says, you know, in the reports that we read, to get a public defender there, you must prove you are indigent.
Meaning you're financially unstable and can't afford a regular attorney.
Hemi's problems just start multiplying. His wife, Ariella Newman, filed for separation after Hemi's arrest. And she's the one. She's the one that brought the affair to light. According to her, she knew Hemi was cheating on her soon after Andrea got hired at GE, because Hemi was taking calls late at night. He was hiding his phone.
She saw a change in his behavior and knew something was up.
So Ariella's divorce attorney started asking for evidence that pertained to this situation. And her lawyer claimed Andrea continued communicating with Hemi after the murder. So Hemi's problems, they're just multiplying. Now, February 24, 2011, the district attorney's office secured a search warrant. They were looking for email and phone records between Andrea and Hemi. That's Andrea Snyderman and Hemi Newman. They claim this affidavit that they had claimed that the two were in continuous communication before and after Rusty's murder. So by now, they're wondering if they're in cahoots.
They find emails, text messages, and thousands of phone calls between Newman and Andrea. So Andrea saying, he made a pass at me, but that's about it. Well, now they're establishing that there was a lot more between the two of them.
So they're going to get a hold of these communications and figure out, well, how deep is Andrea in this situation? Andrea released a statement about this time saying she was shocked that Hemi had been charged with the murder of her husband.
And feeling the heat, she hires her own lawyer too.
Hemi's murder trial began February 21st, 2012. Now, this is interesting, Justin, because obviously the prosecution is trying to win this case and get justice for Rusty Snyderman. The defense is trying to defend Hemi Newman. So both defense and prosecution put their focus and put the blame on Andrea Snyderman. They both claim that she's the one that got Hemi to kill Rusty.
it's interesting when they agree. Now, they're agreeing for different reasons. They're agreeing for different versions and narratives of the theory here on how this went down, but they agree that Andrea is the key.
Andrea spoke in her own defense. I mean, I know she's not on trial, and she denied any affair with Hemi, and she denied any involvement in Rusty's murder.
The prosecutor is going with the angle that Andrea and Hemi were having an affair, and that's the motive, whereas the defense is claiming that Hemi is not guilty for reasons of insanity, and that Andrea manipulated him.
The prosecution brought in a psychologist, and it was said that Hemi was malingering his mental illnesses, and he was a fully sane man who knowingly killed Rusty Snyderman. The DA, Robert James, was saying that Andrea Snyderman was a co-conspirator, and that if you look at their statements, both Andrea and Hemi are basically covering for each other. He said Hemi Newman killed Rusty Snyderman because he wanted his wife, he wanted his money, he wanted his life, period. Newman carefully planned the murder, which shows he was not insane at the time. We've heard this before, Justin. If you have mental illness that is affecting your life, how can you plan a murder? But here's the thing. I don't know how well this was planned. What did he do? He bought a gun. He rented a minivan. He drove to a parking lot. He shot Rusty, killed him, walked back to his minivan, and drove away. I mean, yeah, he put a beard on and wore a hoodie. But I mean, I think about when he's questioned, he has nothing. I don't know how well this was planned. I think he set himself up to successfully kill a person, and he tried to hide himself a little bit, but this is not high-level planning at all. What do you think about that?
I agree, and I don't think we can really establish what kind of mental state he was in. We'll go into more details of with the defense and some of the descriptions of what he was suffering from, but hearing that, keep in mind that Hemi's own wife will take the stand and say she didn't witness any change in Hemi's behavior except a husband that was cheating on his wife.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly, or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
The prosecution also points out that Hemi attended Rusty's funeral, and they think that's significant. And why would a killer show up to a funeral like that, right? So let's go to that morning, because during the trial, they set it up. They say on November 18th, 2010, Hemi Newman got to his office at 5:36 in the morning. They say that was unusual for him to get there that early. And then he snuck out a back door so that he would avoid the security cameras there. So what he was doing was he showed up so the cameras would catch him, but then he snuck out the back door. Again, he's being sneaky, but
he's establishing an alibi that shows that he was at work during the time of the murder.
That's part of the planning he did, you know, and these are basic things you think someone who's trying to get away with murder would do. But, you know, his alibi doesn't really work out, does it?
Now, the defense argued that Hemi was insane at the time of the murder. He was hearing voices. He was delusional. He was being talked to by angels and demons that took the voice of Barry White and other superstars like Olivia Newton-John.
I just don't... that's one of those things where I don't know what to say to that, Justin, except what?
And here's why I give this some merit is because it's so specific. This is, if it was just angels and demons were telling me to kill, that's one thing. But when you actually give them a voice, I'm thinking, is he making this up or is this real? Because it's just very detailed.
And if you go back to the interrogation, the interview, he doesn't have answers for them. And this might actually work with this idea that he wasn't in the right state of mind. I'm not defending him, but it's possible. Maybe he couldn't tap into something because he didn't know what to tap into. It wasn't there.
The defense says Hemi fell in love with Andrea and believed he was the real father of her children. He thought that in order to protect his family, he had to dispose of Rusty. He had to remove Rusty from the situation because he was the true father. They claim that Andrea was a tease and an adulterer who took advantage of his mental illness, his mental state. She led him on, and she also was privy to this whole action because she wanted Rusty's $2 million life insurance policy. So she gets Hemi to go kill her husband, and she gets the big payout.
That's a lot of money.
And it makes sense. So we have both the prosecutor and the defense tying Andrea into this.
You know, it's these interviews that come into play during the trial because the jury got to hear when Hemi was asked if he thought he was the biological father of Andrea and Rusty's children. And his response was, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I feel like these are my children. I feel like I need to be there for them. I feel like I need to raise them and I need to protect them.
I think there are questions here. How does a man who's happily married in a very stable lifestyle turn around and decide he's going to kill another person's husband? And he claims he's doing it because he has to get rid of this guy. But the prosecution is going to come back and say, well, on November 10th of 2010, a week before the murder, Hemi was camped outside the house waiting to attack, but he fled when Rusty noticed somebody was on his property and called 911. And on that 911 call, Rusty's saying he's running. I think he has a gun in his pocket and now he's running away. I don't know who the hell he is and I don't want him by my house. He's wearing a hat and earmuffs and a black mustache. Now we can infer that that was 8 days before the murder. Hindsight's 20/20. So how capable is this man, even in a unstable mental state?
Well, that's just it. If we go with the idea that Andrea coerced him into doing this stuff, it's believable because these are just actions that he's calmly doing. It's, you know, if you said there's a script for him to follow, it certainly looks like that. I'm not saying this is how it went down for sure, but I mean, he just calmly shoots this guy and walks away. I mean, even going into his work, he just calmly goes into work and calmly leaves out the back door. This is stuff that, you know, I don't know. It just, there's something weird about this case, not just the Barry White voice. There's more to it than that, but this is definitely a strange case so far.
Before anyone jumps on us for demonizing Andrea as the evil person that orchestrated all of this. You have to realize that in that first month after her husband's murder, she gave the police nothing. And when she finally did give them a lead, she said, "My supervisor made a pass at me." And then she goes on to deny that there was any affair or anything more than just a professional working relationship. But as more things are uncovered, we realize that Hemi managed nearly 5,000 employees, but he went on special work trips all over the country and internationally with Andrea. And they took one to the UK, where they went on a castle tour together, a dinner cruise, and a West End musical. There was another trip to Greenville, North Carolina, where a bartender witnessed them together. And this bartender thought that they were a newlywed couple. Hemi had his hands and arms all over Andrea, and Andrea was kissing him. Hemi often called his family realtor, Melanie White, to talk about Andrea. He said that he was in love with her. He told his realtor about the work trips that they went on and how he and Andrea laid in bed together.
Now, this is important because all of these witnesses know about how Andrea and Hemi were interacting with one another. So when Andrea was testifying that there was no affair, that Hemi Newman had essentially weaseled into her life and killed her husband because she said no to his advances, you can see why the jury is probably not buying into it. I mean, how could they? This is some powerful testimony. But she's up there saying, "No, this never happened. No affair. He wanted to be with me. I didn't want to be with him."
It was getting to the point where there's questions about, was anyone in their hotel room with them together to actually see them having sex? And it's like, well, they were at the same hotel together on a very inappropriate work trip and going into each other's hotel rooms, and were all over each other at the hotel bars. Any married man or woman out there, if your husband or wife was doing that, would you not consider that cheating? I mean, come on.
Well, this is important because, well, if she's lying about one thing, maybe she's lying about the other. Because she's the only one that's testifying that she wasn't in an affair. Now, she tries to explain herself. She said, "You know, looking back, I should have told Rusty about these advances. I should have quit my job. I should have filed a report with HR. I should have hid from Hemi." Now, she tries to say that there were some things shared with Hemi Newman. She shared personal feelings with him, but she said they never had sex. She did say that he wrote a beautiful poem and gave it to her. And when she was asked about this poem, why he would do that, she said, "He's a nice person." Now, these emails, Justin, she read emails from Hemi about waking up together in Denver and Tahoe. And she said, "I didn't spend the night with him." And she called the emails silly boy emails and said she had asked him to stop contacting her outside of work.
The emails are evidence in writing, and all we have is her claims that she asked him to stop.
She admitted to allowing him into her hotel rooms during work trips, but she said that was before she knew about him stalking her. And after the Greenville trip you mentioned, Andre emailed him, "Now I have to repent." Hemi responded by saying he loved her. Andrea's testimony revealed that they held hands in Greenville and that the emails sounded worse than they actually were.
So she has to repent because they held hands like elementary school kids that went out on a date. Give me a break. Like, is anyone buying this?
So then she's asked about November 18th, 2010. She said she didn't know about Rusty being shot to death until she got to the hospital. And it was around 11 in the morning when she was taken into a private room. Someone came in and told her Rusty had been shot multiple times and was deceased.
So that gives a timetable of what her morning looked like. However, her father-in-law and a friend, so this is Rusty's dad, testify that Andrea called them that morning and said, "Rusty's been shot." That phone call took place at around 9:30 a.m. That's an hour and a half before she was at the hospital, and they explained to her that her husband had been shot multiple times. So she seems to have information about Rusty's demise before it was officially given to her.
There's also the fact that the police had called Andrea a few minutes after the shooting and told her there was an accident involving Rusty. She also called Rusty's parents and sounded apologetic about the shooting. She said, "Rusty has been shot and I'm so, so sorry." So she called multiple people at a time that was well before the time she gave to the court about when she found out about Rusty's shooting death. This is some of the worst testimony that I've heard from a trial, Justin. And I'm sure she would say, all these people are wrong. They're lying about me. They just want me to go down. Some of this stuff is so specific.
She could have sat up there and pled the fifth. I'm glad she didn't. You know, I'd rather watch the train wreck of a person and attempted cover up. But what kind of person goes on the stand and literally contradicts themselves when there is phone records and witnesses?
It's the defense that goes after Andrea about how she never called her husband. When she heard there was an accident, she never called him. That was the first thing she was told, was there was an accident. She never tried to call her husband. And her excuse is, well, because something happened to him, I assumed he wouldn't answer the phone.
It never dawns on you to try calling them? And if you don't know that they've been shot, you don't know that they're at the hospital, like, come on, man. It's just...
Right. Where's the instinct, the emotional instinct? Instead, she's thinking about it and going, well, what's the use of calling him? Now, after she got done testifying, she was actually barred from the courthouse for improper conduct with a witness because her friend, Shayna Citron, had testified against her. She had revealed details about the affair. And outside of the courtroom, Andrea had spoken with her and said, look, I understand you had to do what you had to do. Now you have to live with what I'm going to do.
Going from, I won't even say bad to worse, just going from terrible to just horrendous at this point.
So you have the prosecution that's saying Hemi did this, but that Andrea helped. And then you have the defense saying, well, Hemi was basically being controlled by Andrea. This is literally a trial against Andrea.
I mean, she didn't pull the trigger, but this guy wouldn't have done this without her.
So closing arguments are presented on March 13th of 2012. And of course, Andrea is at the center of both of those closing arguments. And when the jury is deliberating, they make a request to see a video interview of Hemi Newman. Now, in the video they requested, Hemi was claiming to have encountered an apparition. So they're watching this video because they think this might be the key to understanding Hemi's mental state. Hemi also said that when he first arrived at boarding school, he got there too late and he couldn't gain entry. So he slept outside in a shack where he was visited by a demon that told Hemi he was worthless. Now, Justin, having seen some video of Hemi, I know you can't diagnose him, but if you were on the jury and you're watching these videos, do you feel like they're influential? Do you feel like they do illustrate his mental state?
It's a tough one because, again, I know lots of people that are very high functioning who get through their day just fine. And Hemi is holding down a high level management position. He's dealing with very technical things at work. He has a family, yet somehow he's being visited by demons and to the point where he feels the need to murder somebody. Nobody is witness to this instability. His wife, his friends, nobody says there's anything odd about his behavior except that he's hiding his phone. I just got to go with what other people saw and witnessed here. I'm sure he had some instabilities, but at one point they say he has bipolar disorder. Well, bipolar, I am very familiar with, and you can have some pretty erratic manic episodes, but these manic episodes usually don't involve hallucinations. So I don't believe that, I really believe that he's exaggerating his mental state to try to get off here. And I think the jury might agree with that.
Well, the jury had to make a decision. They rendered their verdict on March 15th of 2012. They found him guilty, but mentally ill. So he was sentenced to life without parole plus 5 years for a firearms charge. We said Andrea was being blamed for this murder throughout the trial, but she wasn't put on trial. She just seemed to be at the center of the trial, but her day was coming. August 2nd, 2012, she was arrested on charges of malice murder and criminal attempt to commit murder, but she was ordered to live with her parents. She was on house arrest and later forced to surrender her and her children's passports and wear an ankle monitor. They were getting ready to take her to trial, and they didn't want her running away.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Uncommon Goods. If you're on a mission to be the best gift giver ever this year, it's never too early to start crossing off your list. Whether you're shopping for mom, dad, teenagers, in-laws, or your best friends, Uncommon Goods makes it easy to find remarkable and truly original gifts for anyone. Uncommon Goods wants your holiday season to be stress-free, so check out their selection of thousands of items today. I got the Benevolent Brownies. Let me tell you, the Snickerdoodles are to die for. So shop now and get it taken care of early. No matter what you're into, Uncommon Goods has the perfect gift. From art and jewelry to kitchen, home, bar, Uncommon Goods has something for everyone. Not the same lackluster gifts you can find just anywhere. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high in quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S. They have the most meaningful, out-of-the-ordinary gifts anywhere. And with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice. They've donated more than $2.5 million to date. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/GenY. That's uncommongoods.com/GENWHY for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary.
By the time they get to trial, the prosecution, as they do, will try to figure out what can they make stick. And they'll end up dropping the murder charge against her because they just didn't know if they had enough there. So instead, they offer her a plea deal. You know, they're not going to tell her we're dropping the murder charges. They're just going to say, hey, we'll offer you a deal. And Andrea, who thinks she's free and clear in all of this, shoots that deal down. Now, the DA, Robert James, at trial, is going to argue that Andrea lied and concealed information that she knew about Rusty's death before the police told her, from that phone call and a lot of other details here. Also, that she lied about the affair, which I think is pretty obvious. He also will state that she erased cell phone call logs between her and Newman on November 18th. But texts from before the murder had not been deleted. He alleges that Andrea was having an affair that she denied. And this is all the proof that you need to see.
And her defense team is admitting that there's some blurring of the line of appropriate conduct between Andrea and Hemi. But they claim that most of these counts that the prosecution wants to bring against her lack specificity.
If you remember in that first trial against Hemi, we had Andrea's friend, Shayna Citron, testify against her. Well, prosecutor's going to bring her back onto the stand because she's going to be the star witness against Andrea. She's going to describe Andrea having marriage troubles before Rusty's murder.
Her testimony talked about a visible strain in the marriage. And that whenever Andrea talked about Rusty and Hemi, there was a difference. When she talked about Rusty, she appeared cold. But when talking about Hemi, she kind of sparkled and livened up.
And Shayna will go on to describe how Andrea threatened her during that first trial against Hemi during the hug.
Also at this trial, the detective who worked the case, Andrew Thompson, admitted that it was due to his errors that it took so long before they could arrest Hemi Newman. He said he failed to ask Andrea if Hemi's name was in her contacts on her phone. He didn't look into Hemi Newman's background because, you know, Andrea was saying, I wasn't interested in him. But, you know, we talked about this. It's one of those things where he didn't take it seriously enough right away, but it was in the back of his head. They could have made an arrest very soon after the murder, but it just didn't happen that way. But I like how he's trying to take responsibility here.
Yeah, I don't blame the detectives here because I feel like they were working with what they had, and it took Andrea to finally give them something after a month of silence.
Right, and he just feels like, based on that interview, he should have acted immediately, but he didn't. And he says, this was the first murder investigation that I was in charge of. And, you know, if you're going to cut your teeth on something on these cases, you know, you're not a seasoned detective. And even seasoned detectives make mistakes. So I just like the fact that he's taking responsibility. So Andrea, this trial for her does not go well. Once again, it's just like the trial against Hemi. You know, she tried to defend herself, but you have all these witnesses, all these emails, the phone calls, the texts. I mean, it's really clear.
But the one thing they don't have is Andrea asking Hemi to murder her husband. All they really have is her lying about an affair, her lying about prior knowledge of the murder, her lying about just about everything surrounding this case, but they really don't have anything tying her directly to her husband's death. So that's what they have here during this trial.
I think it's important to note that because, you know, if you look at some of her actions, you might say, well, that shows guilt. Think about how she deleted all the records of their communication on that day. Well, how do we know that she didn't do that because she didn't want to be implicated? She didn't really know he was going to do it. And then she thought, I need to distance myself. We don't know. I mean, I think most people are going to fall on the side that says Andrea is involved. But if you're just looking at it from a legal standpoint, you have to work with what you've got. And all we have is a lot of evidence that she could have been involved. We really don't have a smoking gun here, right?
Yeah.
And we're just setting this up because the jury is going to make their verdict known.
Yeah. They find her guilty of perjury, making false statements, lying under oath, concealment of material facts, and obstructing the apprehension of a killer, which I think you can connect the dots there. I mean, she's lied under her oath, she's made false statements, and she didn't come forward with the information about Hemi, her supervisor, to the police. So this is what she's found guilty on. She's not found guilty for murder or accessory to murder. She's found guilty for all of the lies that she told during this entire time.
There were 16 charges, I believe, against her. And these are, I guess you could say, the lighter charges. I get it. I totally get it. I think the jury is trying to make the best call they can based on the evidence that they have. She seems guilty, but do you feel comfortable sentencing her to 40, 50 years based on hunches, right?
Yeah. And perjury and lying under oath, a lot of these things, they are serious. They can carry 10 years apiece. So the prosecutor, he's asking for a 21-year sentence for all of the things that she was found guilty on. 21 years is what a lot of murderers get. So the prosecutor is saying, hey, let's give her the fullest extent of the law for what she's done, because then we will have justice for what she actually did.
And some would say, who weren't on the jury, if she really was on the right side of this, you know, despite the affair, despite whatever else, if she was on the right side, as soon as the detectives were asking about, was anyone interested in her? That's where she should have just said, well, I have been having an affair with Hemi Newman. She didn't do that. But, you know, what's human nature? It's to deny.
Yeah.
Who wants to admit to this kind of thing. But when it comes to the murder of your husband, that's where I would say you kind of need to break out of your fog, because this is some serious business. This isn't just what will people think of me. There's justice on the line here. And do you care? So again, circumstantial case. And when the jury finds her guilty of these things, well, they really only have weight depending on what the sentence is. And she's begging the judge, who is Gregory Adams, please let me go home. What does the judge say?
He kind of, I hate the term, splits the baby. He sentences her to 5 years in prison for each of her 9 convictions to run concurrently. So 5 years in prison is what she's getting.
Right. If it was consecutive, that would be 45 years, but
she's going to receive credit for time served while she was on house arrest. And she's also going to get credit because she's a first-time offender. So the charges could eventually be dropped off of her record. Now, I think that's a slap on the wrist, but it doesn't stop her attorney from filing an appeal. I'm thinking, you got off pretty easy, lady. Like, I would take your licks and go, but they file an appeal. It's shot down.
Yeah, but I think that's normal. You know, she's looking at 5 years. You've said it before. 5 years, that's a long time. You lose your job. I mean, there's a lot that happens in 5 years. Now, it seems like a slap on the wrist because you know what happens with her sentence. Okay, Andrea served just 10 months of that 5-year sentence. On June 16th, 2014, she went out on parole.
Still, 10 months is a long time and would destroy most people's lives. I think we have this perception that people need to spend more time behind bars to punish them more for what they've done. And I'm sure Rusty's family agrees with that statement. But in this case, I can't say whether or not justice prevailed. I think they got her on what she was guilty of. And then after that point, the system just plays out how the system plays out. And you do get credits for time served. You do get credits for being a first-time offender. You do get credits for good behavior while behind bars. That's just our system. And we don't get to change the system just because we feel more strongly about somebody's guilt than somebody else. Because I'll tell you right now, when you're on the hot seat and you're a first-time offender, you're going to want that leniency.
Well, you said they found her guilty on what she was guilty of. I don't know if they got her on absolutely everything she was involved in. But again, I think that the jury tried to do things by the letter of the law. They tried to work with their instructions that they were given. They settled on the charges that they felt confident she was actually guilty of. I think there were questions about some of the other charges, but it's kind of a moot point. I mean, this is what the jury had to decide. This is what they settled on. And then, well, she had no criminal record. And, you know, we can sit here all day and just say, oh, we think she did this. We think she egged him on. We think this and that. But that's just, those are hunches. Those are feelings. We've talked before about how you and I will make comments that have to do more with our emotional feeling on a case than how courts actually work. And sometimes the courts are too cold. But in a case like this, well, I mean, I'd rather they did what they thought was right. I don't get the sense that they took pity on her.
I'll modify my statement to, they found her guilty on what they could prove. Because you're right, we don't know what else she was truly guilty of.
And she may not have been. I mean, that's a possibility. I know that's not going to be a popular thing to say, but we really don't want to put people away for things that they didn't do. We see the devastation that happens when innocent people get put away. And I don't want hunches and feelings to run a trial. But I do think that we need to check our hearts and think about things before we just willy-nilly start sentencing people to crazy time. We've got enough people in prison as it is, serving long sentences that seem inappropriate. So, whatever her involvement in this case, she has this on her record. And, you know, it's really a question now is this the end of the story of Andrea Snyderman? We know that after her trial and after she was released, there was a lot of turmoil in her community. Because in Dunwoody, there are a lot of people saying, you got away with murder. So a lot of people were taking sides. And it was, I don't know, I guess you could say it was destroying relationships in that community.
I could see it. But unlike a Casey Anthony scenario, she did serve time. She was found guilty of some things. But I understand that this would tear a community apart, tear families apart, because especially Rusty's family, they're going to put a lot of the blame on her. And I don't blame them for doing it. I understand their point of view.
Something significant happened in 2015. On June 15th, the Georgia Supreme Court overturned Hemi's conviction and ordered a retrial. It sort of played out the same way, but a psychologist testified that she thought Hemi had an undiagnosed bipolar disorder and was experiencing a manic episode during the murder. But when this trial was over, the jury found him guilty again without accepting his insanity claim. So, you know, you'd think if there's a retrial, that might help you. But in this case, I feel like it worked against Hemi because he went from being in a diagnostic facility, he could have been treated and his mental illness could have been addressed, providing he had one. He went from there to a regular prison. And it's at this point that Andrea Snyderman released a statement stating that she was glad that the cold-blooded killer went to prison again. Little love lost.
As some would probably think, it's easy for her to say that now.
So some final notes here. In 2019, Hemi Newman filed a request. He wanted a retrial hearing on the grounds of mental illness caused by his intense love for Andrea Snyderman. And in 2020, he appeared for a virtual hearing to appeal for a retrial. That hasn't been decided yet. Hemi Newman's former wife changed her name to Ariella Barconi. And Ariella and Hemi were married for over 20 years. She said she never saw any signs of insanity, mental illness, any delusions. I think she's saying she doesn't believe that stuff. But I think it's telling that he says that he had mental illness because of his intense love for Andrea. I think that's him being honest there.
Love will drive you crazy.
Because we've talked about this. You know, there's all these allegations. Was he really hearing voices of Barry White and Barbara Streisand?
Yeah.
That makes me wonder. Andrea Snyderman has since changed her name to Andrea Russell to honor her husband. I don't even know what that means. Did she get remarried or something?
They call him Rusty, but his name's Russell.
So Justin, before we close this case out, what do you think about her changing her name to honor her late husband? Do you think that it's possible that she really does regret things that happened? Because it seems like all these changes happened well after the fact.
She's doing it for herself, I guess. If she did it to, in some way, try to appease Russell's family, well, I doubt she accomplished anything with that. If she did it to try to appease the people that feel she's guilty of having a hand in his murder, she's not going to be changing anyone's mind. But if she did it for herself, then hey, more power to her, right?
Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen ad-free.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
I understand that anybody who's paid attention to the media would have to come to the conclusion that I killed my wife.
Hi, my name is Zach Stewart Pontier. I'm one of the filmmakers behind The Jinx, and I'm excited to bring you the official Jinx podcast. We'll be revisiting all 6 episodes of Part 1 and watching along with Part 2 as it airs on Max, starting April 21st.
Bye-bye.
The official Jinx podcast. Listen on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.